You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, December 8th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, best-selling author, historian, writer Rick Perlstein on the hustlers, hucksters, hacks, and cowards who helped elect Donald Trump. Also on the program today, Al Gore got played. The EPA's nominee's agenda to destroy the EPA. And meet your new government, generals and billionaires. Sprinkle in a little war criminal.
It's dying 2020.
Trump expected to name a fast food executive as labor secretary. Meanwhile, the recount has ended in Michigan, stopped as a judge determines that Jill Stein has no standing to require a recount. Trump attacks a carrier union leader on Twitter. Death threats follow. Meanwhile, the media's wish list for regulations come to the fore. Kellyanne Conway, women with kids shouldn't take a job at the White House. And energy transfers. The company behind the Dakota Access Pipeline sues to keep building while 200 miles away. Yes, a pipeline has a massive leak. The Cures Act passes. Let the healing, the lack of testing, and the drug company payoffs begin. Meanwhile, Portland passes a tax on excessive CEO pay. But with a Trump GOP SEC, will it even have a mechanism to be applied? All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. You know, there's an ebb and flow to this, I find, and it is often directly related to the amount of alcohol that I've consumed at any given time as to how upset I am about what's happening even before Donald Trump has taken office. I'm in a bad mood about it. Moments ago, I just saw the announcement that a fast food executive is going to be named as labor secretary. I think he's the CEO of Carl's Jr. or something. Is that right? I'm not sure. But, you know, it's like a direct assault on the fight for 15, obviously much of that emanated out of the fast food industry. It is the National Labor Relations Board, which fortunately for the time being, and although I think these appointments come up during the Trump administration, had ruled that, was in the process of ruling that fast food companies had to take responsibility for their franchisees' hiring practices because they had, if not direct control over these franchises' hiring practices, they certainly had were setting the terms enough so that the hiring practices would function in a certain way. And this was very important to holding major corporations liable for things like firings of strikes, and labor practices, and et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know. I guess we will see. what we're going to be doing is basically on a daily basis, taking the temperature and assessing the resiliency of agencies whose heads are appointed to fundamentally undercut the purpose of the agency. The EPA nominee, Scott Pruitt, I should say, Oklahoma Attorney General, is going to the EPA not just to do nothing, not just to roll back EPA rules. The reason why I think they picked Pruitt, because there's a lot of people out there obviously hostile to the EPA, but Pruitt's main claim to fame is suing the EPA. So the handcuffs that are on an EPA head, the handcuffs are there is that there are some statutory requirements for the EPA that outside parties, that individuals, that states could sue the EPA for not maintaining the level of protection and regulation. So they have installed someone at the EPA who has expertise in trying to fight against lawsuits compelling the EPA to do their job. So it's not just someone there who's dead weight. It's someone who is going to actively work against people attempting to hold the EPA accountable to the law that they're supposed to fulfill. Now, of course, it's quite possible that if they get their act together, Congress will repeal these laws. But in the meantime, they don't have to have the publicity of repealing the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act if they have someone there whose career has been marked by legal expertise on that. I'll talk about Pruitt more as we go along. But it's bad, folks. It's bad. Anybody who was harboring any illusions before the election, Donald Trump, you know, at one point he was a Democrat. Understand, this is Mike Pence and really, I mean, more specifically, this is the Koch brothers' wish list. This is as far right of a cabinet, at least in terms of domestic policy, as you could find, period, end of story. I challenge anybody to even name people who could be more far right. We still don't know about Secretary of State. I think there's still even odds that it's Rudy Giuliani, but we'll find out later. But I'm talking domestically. I don't know how more to the right you could get than what we're seeing now. In the meantime, holidays around the corner. Maybe you want to take your mind off of some politics. Maybe you cook some food, cook some comfort food.
Have a nice meal.
Have a nice meal. Read a magazine about a nice meal. Read a magazine where food and culture meet. I'm talking about Bon Appetit. From cooking and recipes to fashion, travel, design, and more, Bon Appetit is something to feed the worldly mind. And frankly, folks.
Thank you.
What do you mean, thank you?
Are you looking at me when you said worldly mind?
We're on radio, buddy. Bon Appetit is a dream for food lovers. Cooking, latest food trends, videos, recipes, travel and events, technology and tools, the best gadgets for the kitchen. So it's not only a great gift idea, it gives you gift ideas. on top of a great deal of $12 for yearly subscription. That's $1 a month. Magazines are getting inexpensive.
It's incredible.
You'll receive an exclusive tote bag for the food lover in your life. Plus, for a limited time off, take 15% off. Just go to bonappetit.com/giveBA. Give ba, as in give bon appetit. Enter the promo code 15 off. So for a limited time, you can give a one-year subscription to Bon Appetit magazine for 15% off. Like I say, amazing seasonal recipes, latest food trends are packed in every issue. It's a gift that keeps giving all year long. Plus, you'll get a really cool Bon Appetit tote bag, perfect gift for cooks, for food lovers. Use the promo code 15 off. That's two F's, Michael, when you're writing that in the podcast today. And start shopping now at bonappetit.com/giveBA. Also, while we're talking about reading about food, what is the perfect gift for somebody who has everything, right? You're not going to buy them. They already have the barbecue. They already have the stove.
They already have the perfect kitchen.
They have the perfect kitchen. Or maybe the kitchen's not great. Maybe their stove is an older stove. I have a very old stove in my house. But you know what? Still has fire come out of it. It cooks.
And it's an incredibly old stove, I got to say, folks. I've seen it. It's a mess.
But if you're struggling to find the perfect gift for someone who has it all, I've got one for you. Omaha Steaks. Everybody in this office has enjoyed a big Omaha Steak gift basket. What do you call it? Gift box? Omaha Steaks gift offers box. Unique gifts for gourmet food lovers. You can have a great steak experience at home. They have veggies, desserts, appetizers, pasta, soups, sauces, much more. Convenient, quick shopping for those on your list. Aged for 21 days. I mean, this makes a great gift, but I'd be surprised if a lot of people don't get it. We've had, every time we get one of these offers from Omaha Steaks, we get a lot of emails thanking us. And to be honest with you, I mean, it's not, I mean, we're just telling you about it. We're not putting it together.
But you're welcome.
But you're welcome. Right now, Omaha Steaks is giving an exclusive savings just to my listeners. Listen to everything you get for less than $50. Two filet mignon. Two top sirloins, two boneless pork chops, two boneless chicken breasts, four kielbasa sausages, four burgers, 12-ounce package of all beef meatballs, potatoes au gratin, four caramel apple tartlets, I'm starving, one Omaha Steak seasoning packet, plus get four additional kielbasa sausages free. Go to omahasteaks.com, enter my code REPORT in the search bar. You got to do it in the search bar, folks. Add the family gift pack to your cart and get a 77% savings. It's the gift guaranteed to be a hit. Get a couple, freeze them for the winter, and you have steak all year, all winter. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, best-selling author, historian, Rick Perlstein.
Thank you.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Always a great pleasure and honor to welcome to the program the author of the best-selling Nixon Land, Before the Storm, The Invisible Bridge, all three of those, I should say, and writer Rick Perlstein. Rick, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here, Sam. This is my daily act of resistance.
Yeah, well, we'll do it for as long as we're here, I guess. I mean, who knows what happens next? So your piece in the Washington Spectator, the hustlers, hacksters, hacks and cowards who help elect Donald Trump. And I think there are, you know, a multitude of reasons why Donald Trump became president. The press, you argue, is the one that historians more than others are going to look back upon. Why that?
Yeah, you know, I'm not really as interested as, you know, kind of pinning blame on what the, you know, ultimate cause of Trump's election is, as what Trump generally, both his election, his transition, and his impending presidency, you know, means for the civic life of the United States and our ability to, you know, reason together and govern ourselves as a republic. What makes it so striking, even, you know, kind of since writing the piece, even doing a little more reading, I've come to a little more clarity on the issue, especially with the amazing commentary of Masha Gessen, you know, who was born in the Soviet Union, moved to the United States to become a journalist, then moved back to Russia to report there, and then had to move back to the United States because she and her gay partner have children, and she was terrified for her life and safety there. So Masha Gessen has been saying that the big picture is that how authoritarians, anti-totalitarians rule is by lying systematically and making disinformation their way to make it impossible to discern an accurate picture of reality. And that by so doing, by debasing the currency of truth itself, they position themselves in a way so they can create their own truth, the better to aggrandize their own power. And that's what's happening. So the routines of journalism, the professional routines, the things that you get rewarded for as a mainstream journalist that makes you successful, is absolutely unable to deal with that. So that's why I say what is required is a literal paradigm shift in how news is covered. Because if you just pick apart each claim he makes and say he says this, other people say that, et cetera, you are actively abetting his game of just basically not seeing what he's actually doing, not reporting the truth, which is that this is a systematic campaign to make it impossible to understand what the truth is. So journalists, and let's be very clear, by understanding themselves to be reporting the truth, are actually getting us farther away from the truth.
Now, by systemic plan, does that mean that that is in his intent, or is it just simply that is what he's putting out there because of, I don't know, a personality defect, and it is being, and then that's those around him and our system is ingesting it, in such a way that it is a systemic problem?
Well, let's move it away from just the consideration of Trump as an individual, although he's the leader and he bears, you know, absolute and total responsibility. Let's look at, you know, the people around him. For example, someone like Steve Bannon,
right,
who in an amazing profile last year by Josh Green in Bloomberg is revealed to be basically a disinformation specialist, that he's has like a very sophisticated multi-pronged strategy to debase the currency of truth as reported in the news media, you know, an inside-outside strategy. You know, let's talk about Trump's, you know, kind of grassroots followers, these, you know, people on Twitter who sit around in war rooms and think about how they can invent lies and broadcast them and turn them into apparent truths. You know, let's talk about let's talk about, you know, the fake news industry, you know, and not even getting into the, you know, question of, you know, what Russia has to do with it. Talk about the people who created news, fake news stories, either as a business model because people click on them and then they distribute them. And even when they get debunked, that becomes a way of getting clicks. But people who have literally made it their vocation to deliberately introduce false information into the public sphere. So it's all this stuff, and right. It's all kind of, kind of orbiting around Trump, right? So is Trump a damaged guy? Does Trump think he's telling the truth when, you know, he says he's saving 1,100 jobs when he's really only saving 500? Or is Trump, you know, what is he doing when he says that Boeing, you know, whatever, has a $2 billion contract, you know, to make Air Force One when, you know, I was listening to Michael Savage, the crazy fascist right-wing talk radio guy, and he was even kind of debunking this, saying he couldn't find any evidence of this. So, you know, what's going on in Trump's head? I don't know.
And it doesn't matter.
It doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter,
right? But what the media needs to do is think about how to represent what is happening in reality to people, so they can use this as citizens. And they cannot do this by fact-checking every claim, by having one person say it and another person say
refute
it's wrong.
It. Right.
They need to make the disinformation the narrative about the Trump presidency.
All right, I want to return back to that, because I want to keep talking a little bit more about this problem, because I mean, on some level, right, I know that you're fully conscious. We have seen this on the right for a long time, right? I mean, you know, outfits like Breitbart have existed for a long time. It's just that now, I think with the rise of social media and not just Twitter, but I also think like YouTube. I mean, I think, you know, one of the big stories I think that has not been covered is really sort of what YouTube has done for that. It's the same sort of situation where you have people who are incentivized, but it's another channel. You know, Alex Jones, for instance, if he was still exclusively on radio, he would have a far less reach, despite the fact that radio, permeates more than maybe YouTube, but it's not shared in the same manner. You don't have the ability to sort of port it to other people in the same manner. And I would argue there are other, you know, there's a lot of people like me out there who, sort of add to that cacophony as well on YouTube. But I also want to just even take a broader perspective in the sense that there's no, and I guess the media is supposed to play this role, but there doesn't seem to be even the subsidiary institutions which have the ability to provide some type of watershed and say like, hey, no, this doesn't, you know, like it occurs to me that the media, while the media, and we can talk about this, about how the media, some elements of the media reported well on Trump, others just sort of, were ultimately an advertisement for it. But it seems to me that had Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, for instance, and they have no incentive to do that, but had they come out and said, no, we're not going to cross this line, then the media would have taken a harsher position. Or had there been other institutions that had stepped up, but we don't have those institutions anymore in this country.
So, they're following the Grover Norquist theory. He said once, all we need in a president is someone who has a working right arm to sign the legislation.
And they were
That's the deal that Paul Ryan has made, right?
Yep.
So, let's talk about those institutions. This morning on Morning Edition, which specifically as a show has been a terrible offender. I find whoever it is running All Things Considered at night, they do a pretty good job. But Morning Edition, for some reason, has been – particularly meretricious. They had a long interview with Sean Spicer, who's an RNC spokesman. And a lot of people, you know, I talked to a conservative here in Chicago where I live. He said, well, the grown-ups will take control of Trump and they won't let him get away with this stuff. So the grown-ups is the Republican Party. And this guy, Sean Spicer, was on RNC basically attacking the media for reporting that Trump lied about the number of jobs that he's saving and saying, you just don't understand Trump. You just don't understand how profoundly he's resonating with the people, which, of course, is a disinformation campaign itself, you know, claiming that he has this enormous mandate. And then he went ahead, you know, and said when he was asked about, you know, Trump's conflict of interest, well, we'll just listen to what he says on, you know, his press conference next week on December 15th. So here's a guy, you know, when people like, you know, Nate Silver at 538 were reporting on the nomination campaign, they were very enamored of this book called The Party Decides, which is a political science book basically saying the parties as strong institutions can get in the way of a demagogue getting the nomination. That was, you know, obviously completely wrong. The party doesn't decide. The party is following, in the case of the Republican Party, you know, they're whoring after power, right? You know, you can look at something like the FBI, which is obviously supposed to be a bulwark institution supporting the rule of law, you know, absolutely, you know, leapfrogging over the rule of law when it came to, you know, Comey's interventions in the election. So all these institutions have weakened. That's a phenomenon that we've seen in our politics for decades. And then we have this guy who's kind of willing to take advantage of the fact that so many of these things that kind of keep us able to communicate with each other and govern ourselves are based not on laws or even formal rules, but norms. So that's another thing the press has to kind of make the center of the story, that they're willing to that he's willing to violate norms. But they have their own norms. And one of those norms is that if you are leading one of the major parties, you're not allowed to say that those parties are breaking norms.
I mean, I wonder if that hasn't left the gate. But let me let's play. You mentioned Morning Edition, and in your piece, you also talk about one interview that Steve Inskeep gave to a woman named Sarah Chase about her experience working with Michael Flynn. And I guess Chase is...
And I didn't even mention she's actually a former NPR employee. So there's kind of like another... She was actually honorable. But anyway, I guess she was. I don't know. We'll talk
Let's
about
Let's listen
it.
To yeah. it. This is a 2.5 yeah. minute clip, but it really is stunning. And this is was on the 18th, I guess the day or so after Flynn was...
right.
Well, not even nominated, chosen. I mean, he doesn't have to be confirmed. But let's be honest. I mean, all of these people, it would take Republicans leaving their own party to stop any of these people. And that seems, at least in most instances, highly unlikely. But here is that that clip.
Although many people have been dismayed by him in the military in the last year or so, as he supported Donald Trump, he was considered a brilliant military officer before that.
He was. My assessment at the time was this guy was brilliant at bringing information in. You know, I mean, he was collecting information from all quarters. He had a bunch of people around him, some of whom would make some of us raise our eyebrows. My assessment at the time was, wow, he's an intel officer. He's got to be a dog catcher. The problem was he didn't seem to know which of his mutts could actually hunt. And that was a really consistent feature was constant contradictions. If you listen to him talking for 10 minutes, you'd hear him contradict himself two or three times. Again, as an intelligence officer, the way I rationalized it was, he's got to get this stuff inside his brain. The problem is that can lead to very contradictory both statements and potentially policies.
Which is interesting because one of the jobs of a national security advisor, of course, is to keep things orderly and make sure that the president gets information in an orderly fashion. Any sense of what he was like as a manager?
Orderly, he was not.
No? You're saying that what do you mean by that?
Anything but. I mean, remember Linus in the Snoopy in the Charlie Brown cartoons?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that.
Okay. Do you mean to say Pigpen?
The one Big Ben.
Okay, the kid who was a little dirty. Okay, so you're saying that things were a little chaotic around General Flynn, but you found this guy to be extraordinarily enthusiastic. Let me ask another thing. Because of some of General Flynn's statements about Muslims, people are going to be asked if he is prejudiced in some way. There you are with him in Afghanistan. He's with American troops, a few of whom would be Muslim. He's in an overwhelmingly Muslim country. How did he handle that?
I never found him in his personal dealings to be prejudiced, either in terms of religion, race, or in particular gender. I mean, interestingly, the intelligence community within the Army is one of the ones where women really can rise to the top. And Flynn always surrounded himself with women and often said, look, it's just diversity isn't even an issue because there's too much talent. I can't afford to lose the potential talent. So on a personal level, I never saw him behave in discriminatory ways.
In just a few seconds, as someone who knows General Flynn, when you heard news of his selection, were you reassured, happy, disturbed, troubled, many questions? How would you phrase it?
My heart sank.
Really? Why?
Everything I just said. The NSA is an institution that, first of all, has to keep the trains running. That's the first job of the National Security Advisor, is to make that National Security Council run.
Okay.
Flynn can't make anything run.
Okay. Sarah, got to stop you there because of the clock, but thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Good talking to you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
You cut off my favorite part at the beginning, where like they took like 30 seconds of precious time talking about how fun he was in the office.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean,
their desks faced each other, and he was fun.
But what struck me was that Inskeep did not hear what she was saying about the. He would bring sources in that would raise eyebrows. In other words, he would be taking he would be taking stuff from freaks
crap.
People who were completely, who might be shady, that's what raised eyebrows mean. And then saying he's a dog catcher. The problem is he didn't know which dog was actually a dog and which one
was obviously his job. And another thing he didn't do was, you know, anyone who did any kind of due diligence about this guy would know that, you know, even people who respected him, like I think it was McCaffrey. Just today, did an interview. She says, I thought he was cool. Then I looked at his tweets. He went off the rails after he retired, and started, tweeting crazy stuff. So it's not even really necessarily relevant information to where he's at now.
And the thing is that when people listen to NPR, there is a presumption of what they're getting. And none of that was there.
Brokers.
Yeah, and it was just completely a... Right. We need to fill this time. Let's do something puffy. And then at the end, this is a nightmare for the country. Too bad we're out of time.
Got to run. Well, you know, the thing about it is, Sam, and this was a long piece, and it talked about other guys, too, kind of just as dilatory a fashion. This is an ideology in the news media, and it's not really kind of acknowledged. I talk about it a lot in my journalism and also my history. Is that, kind of pundits, commentators, they are invested in this idea that, America is a nation of consensus. It's united in a peace with itself, that basically it's a decent place, run by decent people. And you saw this with Nixon when in 1973, when it became obvious to people who were kind of paying attention the same way it became obvious that, Bush was lying about weapons of mass destruction, you'd see pundits and really high level kind of power brokers saying, well, Nixon couldn't possibly be involved. It's his low level people, his, kind of clowns from Orange County, because they couldn't accept the idea that we were being governed by, a criminal. And in the same sense, I talk about a Washington Post headline, actually the same day as a New York Times headline, in which they talked about Betsy DeVos, the kind of billionaire scion of the, the corrupt DeVos family that runs a pyramid scheme Anway. And, anyone who's studied them knows that their business model is fraud. And then Nikki Haley, who was chosen for UN chief, who has no foreign policy experience. And the headline in both the New York Times and the Washington Post was Trump picks diverse cabinets. Right. So there's this need to kind of find a redemption, this constant. Oh, he's getting more serious, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yesterday.
Right? And it's so easy to play into that because Trump knows that if he can nominate Ben Carson and women, that the media will depict him as a decent stand up guy.
Yesterday, the Times, the first headline announcing the pick of Scott Pruitt was climate change dissenter. Dissenter.
That's a pretty noble thing.
Instead
Defense
of
noble,
of course. I mean, in fact, it's co-opting what everybody who's fighting against Trump is saying. Right? It's against the establishment, as opposed to a denialist. They changed it after they got a certain amount of pressure. But so what?
Well, pressure is important.
It is important, and but part of the problem, it seems to me, is you have, and I've got here in my just today stories about the CEO of Time Warner, who was at a, I don't know, some type of Goldman Sachs retreat or something, talking about getting interviewed. Wait, let me pull this out, because this, it seems to me, is the issue behind the processes there. So obviously AT&T and Time Warner looking for a big merger. So Jeff Bukes, right, the CEO of Time Warner, is at... he's at this Business Insiders. It wasn't Goldman Sachs. Sorry, Business Insiders Ignition Conference. I don't even want to think about what that means. But so Bukes is asked a question from Henry Blodgett, and about if he's concerned about Donald Trump's, talks about stripping flag burners of their citizenship, open up libel laws. Is he worried about the First Amendment? He goes on to say, I'm more worried, and we should have all been more worried about the Democrats who wanted to go into Citizens United. Now, this is a guy who knows.
That was a bigger threat to the First Amendment, was Democrats controlling political money.
This is a guy who knows that he has an $85 billion merger that is basically going to have to pass the hurdle of the Justice Department, maybe the Federal Trade Commission, maybe the FCC. You've got newspapers who the New Media Alliance, which is a newspaper trade group and basically a news trade group, looking to get rid of the cross ownership rules for the FCC completely. There's such an incentive for them, broadly speaking, to appease a government. But when you see a guy like Trump who basically says, like, you know how this works. You treat me nice, I treat you nice. I'm not above going, your company's going to get what they want. Your competitor's not, because they were mean to me. They put a picture up with making me look ugly. And they hire people who have, whether they are, you know, and I imagine they have this pressure to NPR too, whether they are, hosts or producers or whatever, who must have the same unspoken ideology of, like, at the end of the day, this is a business. And I'm going to do what's good for my personal business, my personal brand, et cetera. And it goes all the way up the line. How do you?
Well, you know, that's pretty dark, right? Yes. And this is where I kind of like want to pivot in the interview, because this is very interesting. People are like, what can they do about what's happening with Trump? And I'm very committed to the idea that most of the people who are listening, or a lot of people who are listening, are kind of educated, maybe kind of upper middle class professionals, or at least middle class professionals, who are basically in the same sociological circles as a lot of these guys. And a big part of my article, and I really want to stress this, is that with this media coverage of Trump, we are at the razor's edge. We are like kind of like balancing on the seesaw, because every one of the media outlets we're talking about, whether it's the Washington Post absolutely blowing the doors off of Trump's fake, you know, corrupt foundation, or Time Magazine, you know, Time Warner, which published an absolutely astounding essay by a historian pointing out that Steve Bannon seemed to welcome the idea of a world war.
Yep.
They have all done amazing work. And they've also all done terrible meretricious work. So if they're on the razor's edge, and as you said, people can pressure these people and get them to listen and get them to change, this has to be a focus of resistance and activism. Every time you see a headline which is BS, you email that newspaper. You know, every time you hear the New York Times doing something stupid, you email the ombudsman. NPR is an ombudsman, and we have seen that this works. And this is the fight for our life, and people have to get involved in that.
The irony is that, you know, as much as people talk about malign Twitter activism and whatnot, this is the one area I think that it's like that, you know, that Twitter's almost designed for. I mean, you have
access to these reporters. You know, screws you up at the counter and you have 50,000 Twitter followers and suddenly, you know, they change the policy.
I mean, and the thing is that this is also where the media lives, right? I mean, everybody involved in the media is on Twitter at the very least. I mean, Facebook maybe secondarily, but Twitter in particular. And I'm quite convinced that the coverage, I mean, you know, the coverage of that we're seeing is that we saw over the course of the campaign. We don't need to really go into it too much, but was demonizing Clinton in such a way. I mean, like, you know, I saw this clip of Van Jones, and to be fair, let me just say this, I haven't seen the entire interview, but I found this a little bit, I found it a little bit troublesome. So Van Jones is sitting at a table with some voters who were Obama voters, and now they had voted for Trump, except for the mom. The mom who voted for neither one because they were both morally despicable. And I don't know. I mean, and I don't, you know, I have never had particularly the best notion of either Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton in my mind at in any time over the past 25 years, frankly.
But you don't believe that they're running a prostitution ring?
Well, look, I think we need to see.
Exactly, right?
I haven't seen any evidence that they aren't. You know, but I think the idea of a moral equivalency between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, that is a function of the media, right? I mean, there's and it's a function of a real problem. You know, if there was a reasoned argument about like, well, I could say that argument is wrong, but just that impression comes from the media, and I just don't. There's no possible sound way to defend that.
The impression that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are equivalent. Well, you know, that's water under the bridge. You know, we got a new struggle in our hands. You know,
well,
you know, one of the important things is we got to stay present. We got to, you know, focus on what's happening right now, you know, learn from the past, but, you know, don't dwell on it.
Well, then let me ask you this. To what extent do the leaders of Democratic Party institutions have, like, how should they behave? Because I'm sitting here and I've got in my hand, I'm holding it up now. It is a graph of the media reports of Trump meeting with Al Gore and then the media reports of who Donald Trump ultimately picked to head the EPA, Scott Pruitt is literally, if you know, is antimatter to the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. He is being put there not just to slow its roll, but because he's an expert at defeating its statutory purposes.
Yeah.
And
that's right.
But the media covered the Gore meeting, which, and I almost can guarantee you, if I was to pick up the phone and call my dad right now and say, aren't you worried about this EPA thing? The only thing he would know about or say is like, well, but he met with Gore. So maybe he's balancing things out. Well, you know, what do we do about that?
Yeah, well, the people running the Democratic Party need to understand the chess game. You know, it's like you can't do counter moves when he's knocking over the board, right? And that's just a strategic error. You know, this is like, you know, it's like, you know, him nominating blacks and women to his cabinet. It's misdirection, you know. So you know, Democrats, you know, need to understand that. I mean, I think there's a interesting and at this point one in which I'm relatively agnostic about question of whether, you know, they can work with Trump on things that obviously are necessary, like infrastructure, even though it's a, you know, his particular plan is now a, you know, tax abatement scam for developers or the minimum wage, or if you do the Boehner strategy of just saying no and making his presidency fail, which, you know, it doesn't seem to be in the Democrats, you know, DNA, because we're all like, you know, over-socialized and, you know, we are our own, you know, like John Steinbeck said, a liberal is someone who can't even take his own side in his argument. But at the very least, they can understand what sort of tactical move he's making in meeting with Agor. You know, what sort of tactical move he's making in putting Ivanka, up front when it comes to, being the liberal face of climate change and, child care and stuff like that. You know, Ivanka, who, tweeted, that a joke that, it was freezing and snowing on the day, the Senate was holding a climate change, thing. So she's not exactly like she's, an honest broker on this stuff too. And understand that when it comes to his family, they are like a mafia family. They believe in loyalty and advancing the cause, so that's her first priority. The Al Gore's of the world and the Obamas of the world, and the Nancy Pelosi's in the world, at least have to kind of anticipate his moves, two or three moves in advance. And I haven't seen much evidence they've been doing that yet.
Is there a historical precedent to this, at least in this country? I mean, somebody had...
Nixon put in a new right activist to run the Office of Economic Opportunity, and his job was to get rid of it, too. So that's an old...
I guess what I'm talking about is the greater threat, right? I mean, and this is, one of the dilemmas that I'm wrestling with is, there's an AB. Like, are we looking at just a horrible right-wing administration or are we looking at something that is not just a horrible right-wing administration, but something authoritarian and...
I think it's B. I think this is unprecedented. I think that the fate of the Republic is at stake, and, we could easily get to a place where people who believe things like you and I believe might have to put our bodies in the line to protect the very institutions of democracy itself.
Do you think one of my concerns is that the prescription for the B scenario feeds the A scenario, or that the prescription to fight the A scenario feeds the B scenario?
I don't follow you, Sam.
In other words, if we're going to assume that this is, let me just take the alternate view, that it's an A situation, right? That the authoritarianism, that our institutions are strong, we're not going to have this problem. We need to fight him as we would fight a radical Reagan. Exactly. But that in doing so, that opens up the space for an authoritarian turn. Or if we fight him on authoritarian levels, like, for instance, so you don't want to necessarily give this guy some type of credibility. You want to fight him at every turn and show that there is dissent, because that to me seems to be the most important thing that you can do in the context of fighting an authoritarian force. However, there are some, like, I think the reason why Al Gore went to that meeting, I'm going to assume the best of intentions by everybody, that Al Gore went there thinking, like, if I can sit in the room, maybe I can convince him that, global climate change is real. And if I have a 1% chance of doing it, it's worth it. But what that ends up...
I think that the evidence is so overwhelmingly on the side of B and these kind of serial disappointments that, anyone who... puts their hand anywhere near his mouth gets it bitten off, should be showing us, what the game is here. And I don't know how to build that resistance. I don't know what you do on Capitol Hill, but I think I can speak to you and the listeners that, kind of our markers that we lay down, for our children, for our grandchildren, for the sake of history, that's what's important, that's what, will be judged on, how well we stood up when the going got tough, and just assuming that the grown-ups in the room are going to rescue us. It's amazing, this China, call, this call with Taiwan, which anyone who knows anything about geopolitics, who knows more than Donald Trump about geopolitics, knows, is risking very, very dangerous outcomes. Now we know that the grown-up of all grown-ups in the room, Bob Dole, was the guy who lobbied for this.
Right.
So, any faith that, Mitt Romney is going to ride to the rescue, we're going to need a coalition that'll probably have to include Republicans who refuse to go along with it. That's a pretty interesting eventuality. But let's not you know, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's realize that, you know, just like, you know, Roosevelt made an alliance with Stalin, he had no illusions about what Stalin was all about.
Right. We're going to be all riding on those horses as we charge Washington, D.C., and I'm going to look to the right of me, and David Frum is going to be riding on the horse next to me. I'm going to beat myself to a pulp. Oh, gosh.
I'm willing to extend the warm hand of fellowship to David Frum in the interest of, you know, fighting to live another day.
But may I just interject?
Michael wants to interject.
Stein 2020.
Who's Michael?
Michael is our contributor producer here, and he's...
Hi, Michael.
He can't help himself.
Yeah, I can't.
We're still mad at the at some quarters, but that doesn't matter. All right. Well, Rick, I know that we're going to be talking more, and I think, you know, at the very least, for people who are asking, like, you know, what can they do now? The working on the media, holding the media account,
right?
And do it. You know, look, I think people, you know, I remember. I think it was Michael Massey from the Columbia Journalism Review in studio with me 12 years ago, you know, talking about how he had talked to reporters who would get 3,000 emails from mm-hmm. conservatives when they would write something and it changed their behavior. And, you know, the Majority Report in that era was very much oriented to that. And to a certain extent, we need to get back to that. And people need to remember, when you approach these journalists, right, you've got to be gentle but firm. Is that the prescription?
Yes. Don't insult them. Don't give them an excuse to ignore you. You know, because, you know, we are the majority. This is the Majority Report, you know.
Indeed. Rick Perlstein, thank you so much for your time. We will link to the piece, of course. Always a pleasure, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. Vince Ramos, Sam.
Indeed. Bye-bye.
So good for the left.
That's all that Michael says around the office.
That's
now,
all
folks.
I can do. That's
it's
my
all
only,
he just like just literally every third thing he says is either Stein 2020
you.
Or so good for the left.
So good for the left. What else can you do?
It's
also just annoying to me because it's like our lives were wasted in the last couple of months of this, like, potentially, I don't want to necessarily be overly melodramatic, but pretty, I mean, historically significant, whatever way you spin it. And we spent the last couple of months an inordinate amount of time not talking about staving that off, but being like, the emails show that Politico got an email from Hillary's campaign director. You know, it just sort of brings back how incredibly stupid that all was. But anyway,
you don't know what emails the Chinese could have broken into. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is talking to every world leader on a completely unsecured phone.
Yeah, the money was funneled to the foundation through a third broker to give money to deal with malaria. But the Clintons are fucked up. Anyway, you take
all
my
right.
point.
Well, I mean, I think we should take Rick's advice and attempt as much as we can to not relitigate the stupidity of some of the stupids. But I do think that, and understand, like, there is, that this isn't just about the mainstream media's behavior.
No.
I mean, I... for the most part, I know that in my own sort of Twitter use and email use, and I think based upon how people respond to me, I tend to be more responsive and engage with criticism more than I think the average person, just probably in general.
I think that is a extremely safe assumption.
But it's certainly, you know, with the right approach, I think, you know, I have a little more latitude for people coming at me with the wrong approach. I mean, my baseline is, if you're going to come at me with an anti-Semitic poster talking about all the Jews who run the media, I don't want to see pictures of David Pakman and, you know, some guy from Vox and everybody else and me not included in the picture. If you're going to come at me with some anti-Semitic meme that you've done up on Photoshop, and if my picture's not in it, I'm going to be offended. Because at the very least, I want, you know,
I want the publicity. You want credit where credit's
due. I want the marketing.
I understand.
But aside from that.
Good job, Jewface. Oh, I'm sorry I didn't include you in that.
Exactly.
I apologize.
Honestly, they just come back like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, you know, I'm going to mute you unless the next meme you send at me includes my picture. But my point is that you can approach on Twitter not just reporters in the New York Times or the Washington Post or CNN hosts, but you can also do this with people who do YouTube videos.
You can do it with us.
And, you know, be respectful. And I like Rick says, don't give them an excuse to ignore you.
That's right.
When you're coming at somebody with a point, don't add editorial around that point. You know, this is something that you can go back and listen to some of the interviews I do with libertarians. This is something that I am very, very conscious of. We all tend to want to get like an extra dig in there or give a little bit more weight to what we're saying by adding a sort of half innuendo or a, I mean, I know that I tend to disregard arguments from people who come out to me by saying like, blah, 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 you're a Hillary shill because you said this. Good luck getting your MSNBC job. When I
good
see
luck
that part,
with that.
Or like, I tend to go like, oh, well, this guy's a, I'm not going to listen to
this
guy. This
is not a credible person.
They don't know. They're presuming my intent when I know better. And then I can easily dismiss everything else they say. I don't, generally. I'll still engage.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But most people will, at that point, dismiss you.
If you are not Spock with an emotional disorder,
that's right.
You will block them.
Most people are invested emotionally in things. And I am just, it is not uncomfortable for me to be in that situation where someone is relentlessly attacking.
Yeah, that's. I also would like to say, as far as relitigating goes, if representatives of the dumb dumb left come to us, like Wes,
don't say us, say yourself,
say me. Okay, me, fine.
Come because to I'm me.
Come to me. Just tweet at Sam. Tweet at Sam about his MSNBC gig. He'll be happy. But if you want to come to me, like Wes Clark Jr. and get on your knees and apologize for all of the stupid arguments you have made and how you have disrespected me and my people and bow before me.
This is what happens when you do a Trump impression for 15 months.
Pollutes
it just becomes
psyche.
To like absorb into your flesh.
This is the cultural function of the presidency. See, it distorts everything. That's another thing people are going to miss about Obama.
You know, my neighbor today, well, I'll talk about this on the because we were taking a walk down to work today, and he had an interesting theory, and I think he's right about this. But we'll talk about it in the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. Also, folks, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member of the Majority Report. Support this show. Pennies a day. Pennies-ish a day. I mean, people could do it with pennies, but that would be inconvenient. But certainly, nickels or dimes would be easy. Easily paid for in nickels and dimes per day by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. We also gift. You can give a gift. Give a gift of the show. Oh, God, I got to do this. I'm going to do this afternoon. But for now, it's cucknation.org. It's so embarrassing that the only URL we can get together is a joke URL by a listener. But if you go to cucknation.org or you email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com.
There's also a link just to it on
A link on the blog post to get a gift. You can give somebody 1 month, a year, any month term in between. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. And if you buy crap from Amazon, Do it at majoritypoortkickback.com. Take a quick break. We'll be right back. Take your IMs. Take your phone calls.